afternoon. Now I waited like 2 seconds. It seemed weird, huh?
Yeah.
Good afternoon. And welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. It is March 2nd. Welcome to St. Patty's Day run-up. My favorite time of year.
March is a great month.
It is a great month.
Yeah.
I have a nice nice green flag out front to make St. Patrick's Day great again. This is special for my neighbor.
You should get one that says, make my birthday great again.
Oh,
yeah.
That's right, because Bill's birthday is the end of March.
Yeah.
The very end.
Yep.
We'll do something for that.
24. Again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nice. Yep, you've got birthdays made for radio.
That's right.
As they say. So my name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Now that we know that, and his birthday's on March 30th. Robert, who does our archives, his birthday was yesterday. Robert, do you want to claim you were 24?
No, I was 57.
Oh, 57. He's going
57
for
57 again.
He's going for 57. Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm 63, and that's real, so there you go. I don't care. It's not worth lying about. What the heck? So, hey, for all those of you who just in random information who thought that, you know, things like when President Trump says he's going to be a king, if you're, say, calling your congressman's office or your local officials demanding to have that corrected because he thinks he's a king, that's called joking. That is joking. And the way you know that it's joking is because it's funny. And that's a dead giveaway. And if this is if this is informational for you, I have a cure. It doesn't involve any kind of, you know, group or, you know, you don't have to drive anywhere really.
You don't have to join a club.
No, you can just like go on Amazon.
Three-step program.
Yeah, go on Amazon or maybe find like somebody that you find annoying because they're probably funny. And they probably have all of Gary Larson's Far Side cartoon books. Just go get one. And if like half of them don't make sense to you, then you're going to need the professional help.
Yeah.
But other than that, there's going to be some joking.
And we have some recommendations there, too, who you can go buy. It's going to cost more than a Far Side book.
I mean, really. How do we know it's joking? Well, I don't know. It's funny. I know how to do it. So, moving directly into our more serious topic. Honestly, for all those of you who have listened to the show for the last 15 years, you'd be like, oh, my God, they're talking about wolves again? Yes, we are. Because all of the stuff we told you, like 12 or 13 years ago.
Yeah, I was going to say, how long ago was it since really we talked about wolves?
Yeah.
It's been a long time.
I went back and researched the shows. I was like, true,
yeah.
That was a while
ago. We gave them time to mature and breed and multiply.
Well, we kind of said that all these things would happen and... Well, shazam, you know, they're happening. So we are going to chat today with Mike Costello. He is with an organization called HOWL, H-O-W-L, in case I don't enunciate properly, HOWL for Wildlife. They educate the public, both non-hunting and hunting, public, not the howling thing, about cultural, economic, ecological, conservation, and sustenance sides of hunting. We then give people tools to take action on hunting, fishing, and conservation issues. So they have a really, really wide range of information and ideas, and it isn't all just like, you know, how to buy a nice pocket knife. It isn't that kind of stuff. It's very interesting. They do a lot of things with... the legislature and how to empower people. And I was at a meeting with him the other day, and he gave people some really excellent advice. I'm going to make him do it again. But our new best friend, Mike Costello, is a lifelong Californian with an affinity for big open spaces that make the Golden State special. He's drawn to the high alpine basins, scrubby sage-covered deserts, and the salt, surf, and sand of the coast. What about the redwoods? We left them out. Okay, I'll take care of the redwoods. He believes that our connection to nature goes beyond the need to observe and preserve. He sees human participation essential to ecology. Stewardship, harvesting, balancing, and protecting healthy ecosystems are rights and responsibilities that we must hold on to. At HOWL for Wildlife, Mike contributes to communications strategy. They believe that hunting is human and that modern regulated hunting is the most economically and ecologically sustainable tool for conservation. And I have to say, I agree with 100% of that.
Yeah.
And I know Bill does too.
Yeah.
There you go. So, Mike, I don't know where you want to start today, because this is a deep, deep topic.
You nailed that intro. Thank you.
Yeah, well, you and I are only two of, what, six or seven? Although I shouldn't post all their pictures, but I did take pictures from the our vantage point the other night up in Alturas. And yeah. The stark difference between an angry mob listening to bureaucrats tell them word salad stuff about wolves and you explaining how it really works was stunning, actually.
Yeah.
I got a little bit of applause, which was really surprising, and I was thankful for it, because everybody that went before me, it was some stone cold silence.
Oh, yeah. That was like
conversation.
Well, and you know, full disclosure, you know, I kind of leaned over at one point and said, "It's a good thing there's no rope in this room." Like, it was ugly.
Yeah.
It was ugly, and people are sick of it, because, you know, I mean, wolves, for anybody out there who still doesn't know this, wolves kill to eat, they kill to teach their young, and they kill for sport. And sport doesn't mean the animal dies. It means they chase them around, bite them, or whatever,
right.
Eat parts of them, and then leave them.
Yeah.
They are an apex predator for a reason. Like, that's why we call them that. And to think that
they're
just like fluffy big dogs, right?
They're beautiful. And I think that's one of the problems is they're beautiful animals, and they're closely related to the dogs that we have at home. And so it's of course there's going to be an affinity to liking them charismatically, emotionally, but from the practical aspects of wolves just get left out of the conversation too often. And it becomes a discussion of the extremes. And you know, that's just never healthy.
No.
It's never healthy for actually creating solutions.
Well, then there's kind of that, avoidance of history, which we see a lot in huge amounts of environmental policy, is an avoidance of history. And I'll post the article because I found it again the other day. It's really easy to look up. But in 1911, a wedding party of, I think it was like 125 people, was attacked and killed by a pack of wolves in Russia. Now, I mean, so when people say, well, they never attack people, like, well, over 100 years ago they did. When there were lots of them. So wolves are not that... You just don't want them in your...
No.
You know, you don't want them
If they decide they want to come after you, they're going to come after you, and good luck.
Yeah. I'll also post the pictures of the kids in the cages that we used to talk about over 10 years ago down in New Mexico, because the kids were viewed as little snacks. And so people didn't want to leave their snacks standing on the side of the road waiting for the school bus because the wolves were waiting for them. Which happens when you get enough of them. So you want to tell us about your organization, or you want to talk about wolves and hope we have time for your organization, I think, is the communications director.
Yeah, I think we'll talk about the organization
yeah,
first.
Good call.
And then we'll move into the other issues. Howell, and you read through the intro perfectly there, and you extracted from our website, you know, really a really good summary of what we do. We focus on advocacy, we enable advocacy, we focus on strategic communication that gets to decision makers when a decision is being made. And typically that would be like a regulation change regarding hunting or legislation regarding hunting or wildlife management. And I think the first thing that we noticed a few years ago was that hunters as a community, they like to be in the woods, disconnected from all the stuff that happens, you know, down at the Capitol. Like, that's what's going on at the Capitol is usually the antithesis of what a lot of people that hunt want to deal with. And so we've been removed from a lot of that organizationally and as a community. And so, but we also have seen over the years rights, privileges, opportunities, you know, things that have to do with wildlife and hunting opportunity, those things have been degraded kind of systematically. Every state's had a little bit of degradation. California's had a lot.
And well, they changed the name. I mean, it used to be the Department of Fish and Game.
Fish and Game.
Which went so well with the Department of Fun and Games, but anyway, we enjoyed that a lot, and now they've turned it into wildlife.
Yeah, Fish and Wildlife, and for some reason, CDFW has to deal with cannabis, too. It's not under agriculture. I don't get that. But we've seen these things degraded, and so there's a sense or a sentiment that we as a community are always going to lose. We're always going to lose if there's a threat to hunting. And this came up with black bear hunting in California. And, you know, we saw about 30,000 tags for black bear hunting in California. We maybe harvest only about 1,000 bears a year right now. But there's 30,000 human beings that buy a tag to go out into the woods and hunt bears in California. And so this attack came through primarily through the Humane Society of the U.S., HSUS, to ban black bear hunting. And it was kind of a tipping point for us as a community, for hunters. And I'm talking about from waterfowl to deer to rabbit hunters to squirrel hunters to bear hunters. Like the whole hunting community realized this is going too far. This attack on a sustainable harvest of an abundant critter that provides good protein, good resources for people to take off the landscape was too much, and the community of hunters across numerous species and really across state lines even came together and said, heck no. Like, we're going to tell you who we are and why this is valuable to us, why this is important to us at a personal level. And we were able to convey to the commission stories about hunting and values of hunters that they were not hearing. They were just seeing the very, you know, antagonistic and divisive rhetoric from the HSUS about who these people are that go out and slaughter these animals. And we weren't presenting that value statement. We weren't those people that they thought we were. And the commission realized, you know, we're going to support this unanimously. We're going to tell the department, yeah, go back and revise and update your management plan, get your science better. But this hunt is important for a lot of reasons that we weren't even aware of. And the reason the commission wasn't aware of it, because we weren't telling our stories. We weren't taking the time to share our values and the reasoning behind them into that venue or even into the public space. And so we left the arena unattended to where, because we didn't like the rules. We didn't like the rules. We didn't like the rest. So we left the arena unattended. And that meant that the anti-hunting industry could define these stories for us. And they never do it favorably. You know, the anti-hunting animal rights extremists, animal protectionist extremists, they never tell the story of the hunter in a favorable light. And so we kind of left that void to be filled by somebody that was never going to represent us. And that's what HAL is all about, is developing the value statements that who we are, why we do what we do, the fact that we love critters. Like, nobody goes out and hunts an animal because they're angry at it. We don't hunt.
I never really thought about that, but I bet they do think that.
Yeah, even wolf hunters that hunt wolves in Idaho, they're pursuing adventure. It is physically and mentally and emotionally, psychologically demanding. It's one of the most demanding hunts in the world to hunt wolves. They're not angry at those animals. Those animals are being wolves. You know, they're doing what wolves do, and they're going out and pursuing that animal. There is a conservation ethic to what they're doing because they know that they're helping balance an ecosystem. But they're not angry at the wolves. And so we're not angry at these animals, any of them. So we've got to capture those statements and those reasons for why we participate. And the reasons are as diverse as
you also have to include like a little bit of logic, right? So, I mean, that's like saying that when ants take over your kitchen, you just suddenly develop a hatred for ants, which it's not a very good example. I guess there is that. But you're not killing the ants because you hate them. You just don't want them in your kitchen. Like, I don't care what they do outside. Go
get out of my space.
Go do ant stuff outside. But stay out of my cupboards and off the dog.
No, that's a great analogy. That's a perfect analogy.
I mean, it's silly because I don't care where you live. You deal with things that don't belong there. You know, we all kind of have our space. And the thing is, ants, although they're kind of destructive and kind of make you crazy, they're at least not going to kill you in your sleep. Well, I guess if you lived in a foreign country, maybe they have those kind. Robert's scoffing at me. He doesn't think so. I'm going to research and I'm going to find out.
Well, some kind of little six-legged insect that will.
See? Thanks, Mike. That's why I like you. That's why you're my new best friend. We have to take a really quick break. We're here with Mike Costello from Howl for Wildlife. Bill is absorbed in their webpage, and we've lost him. We've lost him to the internet, but we'll get him back.
A lot of good information.
Come back.
Oh, take a quick break. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at
wethepeopleradio.us.
He's back.
That I see walking in these woods. Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good. You're everything a big bad wolf could want. Listen to me, Little Red Riding Hood.
Darn, we cut off the howl at the beginning. That's the best part. Yeah, that's the kicker of it. Robert, before he left, pointed out that they do use ants for torture. So, yeah, there is that. Ants are back in the blacklist. So, you guys are not. There are a lot of organizations that are like have great information, lots of camaraderie, terrific websites, all that. But they're basically kind of clubs. They're not action oriented, and they're not. Your website, I thought your organization. It seems like it's a kind of old expression, but you seek to load people's mouths. You know, give them the right stuff to talk about. And the right way to approach the problem. And I wanted you to tell the shoot, shovel, and shut up thing before we forget. I thought that was important when you shared that with people the other night. And initially I thought, oh, they're going to attack you too. But they didn't. It made sense.
Right. Well, folks thought I was from a pro-wolf advocacy group because the name of the organization.
Right.
And so we get that sometimes. And I think it's fair to say that it was a strategic decision of our own to have a name that's a little bit ambiguous as to, like, you know, where we stand in the space. Because we actually do believe that all critters have a space on the planet. Like, we should have room for all wildlife. But there's also a management requirement in doing that. And humans are part of that, too. Humans have to have space. So you called out, you mentioned the shoot, shovel, shut up thing. Because a lot of hunters, I believe, have a great sense of disenfranchisement. They feel powerless in a lot of these issues, especially dealing with wolves and grizzly bears as they're being, you know, allowed to recolonize North America. Oftentimes with no support for the local stakeholders that are actually affected by those animals, there's an equally negative response to that disenfranchisement, and it's often just, you know, shoot, shovel, shut up. We're gonna kill these animals no matter what. You know, I see that animal, I'm gonna kill it. And I think 98% of that's bravado, just kind of false internet warrior, keyboard warrior bravado. And it's a way of saying in three words or three letters, I'm angry about this. I have no voice. You don't give me an opportunity to participate in the process. And so this is how I'm going to react. But when we say that, we literally are making the very inflammatory rhetoric for the other side of the deal, the pro wolf at any cost. We're making their propaganda for them. Like, we're literally packaging up, you know,
yeah.
our frustration and giving it to the other side so they can use it against us. Because ultimately, I really don't think most people truly feel that way. I don't think if people are actually doing that, they're talking about it. And I think the most people, you know, let's say the 10% or the 80% of the folks in the middle that live in the suburbs, they've got a mortgage and two jobs, three kids, a dog, and a softball team to coach. They're just busy. Like, they're just busy, and they want to know that the critters are doing okay.
Yeah.
And so when we say that, we fall into a trap of, you know, those people that just want to know that the critters are going to be okay, they will immediately turn against us because there's no context, they don't understand the frustration, and they've got this other argument that's being presented by the wolves at any cost advocacy groups of a beautiful animal with a slogan that says, those people just want to kill all the wolves. And then we say that, and
mic check.
We make their case.
Yeah. See, yeah. That's the kicker. Because it does make their case. And I sat through all those stakeholder meetings prior to the listing, and that is what they said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And so we have to think strategically. Like, we have to think and talk strategically, because what I think we don't realize is that those advocacy groups don't represent 80% of the people. They're a very small group of people that are ideological.
There is something bizarre going on with our...
Something going on. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you fine, but...
Can you hear me now?
Your coverage is excellent, but we've been infiltrated by some sort of electronic thing.
Yeah. Those advocacy groups are ideologically driven, and they're a small group of stakeholders. They're a very small group of people, but they're loud.
Yeah,
and they think and speak strategically, so we have to do the same. We need to think about, like, what's the average voter who ultimately, you know, does have a say in this, whether we like them to or not. They do have a say in what electeds and commissions and, you know, what those folks are going to do. So we need to think about what's the right argument that makes progress on behalf of what we're trying to achieve, and that's for humans to have space. That's for ranchers to have space where they can feel protected and they can have their livestock and they can steward their animals. It's so that the wildlife, the other wildlife on the landscape can have space. The mule deer, the elk, the antelope, you know, et cetera. We can't, it's not healthy. I don't think it's healthy to introduce. You got to acknowledge that when wolves and grizzly bears are recolonizing an area, it is disruptive to not just the people, but also the other wildlife. And I think we as humans have a responsibility to moderate that disruption, protect the humans settled areas, and also protect some of the wildlife that are also naive. They haven't seen wolves or grizzly bears in hundreds of years or 100 years.
True.
So we can steward them successfully too by not forcing, like in Colorado, the reintroduction is basically a forced acceleration of putting wolves into places that they haven't showed up naturally on their own.
Well, that was California.
Yeah.
I mean, California, they were not here. They weren't.
There's a debate there. Let's talk. I think that's a good debate, you know, whether or not they walked in or not.
Well, I mean, there was a lady sitting in the front row of that meeting that we attended last week that has video of the helicopter and the four-wheeler, because it was on their property, you know.
Yeah, I'd love to see that.
Yeah, where they pushed OR-7 across the border.
Okay.
But multiple times over a period of, I'm guessing at this point, but it was long, like I'm going to say 8 months, maybe. Mm-hmm. It didn't happen just one time. It wasn't like someone chased him, he ran across the border and went, oh, my God, California is so yummy, I'm going to stay. Like, it didn't really work that way. But yeah, all during those stakeholder meetings where they were, you know, coming up with their plan or whatever, just in case, there were these repeated sightings of the people who live up there. And it was on the 97 corridor. It wasn't everywhere. It was really really on the backside of Klamath Falls and like Siskiyou and Modoc counties where they come together there.
Wow.
So anyway, I mean, so people really felt like they were getting played.
Sure. And because the goalposts are set so far apart, like there's no management in, you know, there's a management plan, but effectively when you have, you know, it's a $100,000 fine, like 10 years in prison if you shoot a wolf because it's on the federal list, with almost no context available for you to do anything to defend your property, defend your livestock, the animal has to be attacking you directly. And so the goalposts are set so far apart that, people are just frustrated and they want, and we're gonna naturally latch on to extremes of the discussion. And we often lose sight of whose mind do we have to change? Like yeah. We have to, and right now, you know, this is, delisting is going to be considered in the at the federal level in the legislature, and whose mind we have to change is 60 senators.
Yeah.
Well, maybe 10.
Yeah, I was going to say, we probably only need like, yeah, I mean, we should shoot long, but, you know, maybe 6, 7, 8,
yeah.
Something like that. And the bad part is that some of them that could have come along with us, like maybe Tester up in Montana, we already flipped those seats. Oops.
Right. Right.
But
we locked that vote up, but it wasn't.
Yeah, too bad. It's and you know, you look at Schiff and Padilla in California. They should care about their constituents in California, but I'm pretty sure that there's not a lot of.
There's no.
It's not affecting.
Yeah, it's not affecting 95%
of the state.
Yeah. Do they feel that the introduction into Yellowstone was a success?
Well, it depends on what the goals are. I think most people would say that the introduction, if the goal was to reestablish wolves in the Northern Rockies, I think that you would say, yeah, it was successful. Wolves are there. There's been, you know, there's this theory of a trophic cascade where the entire ecosystem, you know, changes and evolves.
The guy with the accent. I'm totally posting that video.
Yeah.
That guy makes me want to harm someone. Yeah.
Yeah, they leave out other environmental factors. They leave out that beavers were also introduced at the same time, and beavers are probably did more of the engineering of the creeks and streams and rivers in Yellowstone than wolves did. I mean, it crushed the elk population by 75%.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at. Is the elk were heavily populated in that area, and they've been pretty much decimated, haven't they?
Yeah. I mean, they're 25%. I think they're about 25% of historically before wolves were introduced. And there are people that would say, well, that's nature. That's the natural status of things, and that's okay. But you know, the Earth. I like to say the Earth is not a snow globe. Like, we can't remove ourselves from it and just stand back and not be part of it. Humans have been harvesting protein from the landscape since the beginning of time, and we've been competing for resources, competing with wolves for resources in space. Since the beginning of time. And so you have to make a really big values statement to say that it's right to have wolves dominate the landscape and reduce the elk by 75%, because the only way that's really a great thing is if you're saying that humans shouldn't have the opportunity to also harvest from the landscape. Why don't we? You know, I think we do. I think wolves could be there. Like, wolves were always there. That's fine. But we also competed with them, and now we compete with them still. And so, but we're being forced into this box, especially in Northern California and Eastern Oregon and wherever wolves are, you know, newly recolonizing. We're forced into a box where basically the humans just have to stand by and watch, even as wolves are severely affecting wildlife populations and severely affecting domestic livestock populations. And that's where people feel powerless, and that's when they feel the most likely to say the thing that turns off the folks in the suburbs from supporting us.
Yeah.
It's a very hard space to be in.
Well, the thing is, how long, and we heard people ask this, I mean, they're losing animals.
Right. And
you know, for anybody who maybe doesn't live in a rural area listening in maybe some other state, I don't care where you live, your meat comes from somewhere. It's raised
probably by a rural area.
Yeah, it's made raised by a rancher somewhere.
Right.
And that's the, I mean, that's where these cattle live is amazing country. These are not feedlots. These are in incredible spaces with open grazing areas. But then you allow the wolves to overpopulate, and there's no check on that.
Yeah.
Wolf takes cattle every time.
Yep. And right now it seems like it's multiple times a week right now.
Oh yeah. I mean it's rock versus paper. Paper never really, you know. I mean, it's bad. One of the ladies who was there the other night said she was driving. They have like 40,000 acres, and she was driving into town or somewhere, and she said she spotted 9 different animals. Just in various stages of either dead or dying.
Wow.
So
that's brutal.
Yeah, it is.
These
brutal.
Folks are stewards. You know, the. I mean, yes. If you have livestock, you have dead stock. You know, life and death are humans are so removed from life and death. Like it's crazy. And so, if you're a rancher and you got 1,000 animals, you are going to have some that die. But it hurts. Like it's not just like. You know, it's not just a transaction where you say, oh, the wind shifted and we had an animal die. Like, the ranchers care. And so, you know, yeah, ranching is hard and livestock, there are deaths in the herd, but you do everything you can to prevent them and protect animals. And then when you have, especially the most, vulnerable of them being calves or new, you know, cows that are giving birth to a calf. When you have those animals being the ones that are so quickly and easily attacked by wolves, they weren't sick, you know?
Right.
They weren't sick.
Oh, my
they
God.
Weren't hurt.
You heard that?
It was just, yeah. You know, they're most vulnerable, maybe at their healthiest, you know, but most vulnerable moment in life, and they're attacked. And then, like you said, a lot of these wolves, they will kill more than they need for their own consumption.
Oh, yeah, they're not eating them all. And I do, oh, that brings back bad memories. I do remember back in those idiotic stakeholder meetings where they were crafting their wolf plan. Oh, but by the way, there was never any paper and no one ever wrote anything down, so I'm not really sure how much input was really being given. But they used to say, oh, no, the wolves only eat the weak. They cull the herd. They only eat the weak animals and the sick ones and the dying. And I'm like, you know, if you think about that from a human perspective, that's like going to the grocery store and picking up all the bad produce. Like,
right.
I want the potatoes with all the black spots and the brown lettuce. Like, because I'm gonna make the vegetable and fruit section better. Like, what?
Yeah.
No one does that.
I think Disney had that woven into some of their movies. And it sounds great. And there's probably a little bit of truth to it, but it's not what they do.
Like, well, they might snag the slow
runner.
They're
going to go after whatever they can.
Yeah. The guy who runs too slow might grab him, you know, like the old joke, you know, how do you outrun a bear?
Yeah.
You know, run faster than your friend. But, yeah, that's just silly. We have to, on that note, we have to take a really quick break again. This is going to go really fast, darn it. I better shut up.
Yeah, I want to talk about wild wolves.
Okay. I get all jacked up about this. I'll put my muzzle on. Probably unlikely. Okay, we'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Our guest is Mike Costello with Howl for Wildlife, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
every day now, never meaning what they say now, never saying what they mean. While they while away the hours in their ivory towers, till they're covered up with flowers in the back of a black limousine. Whoa, la da da.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the games people play, Mike.
Yeah, the wild wolves.
Yeah. So if there's probably a few people listening, maybe one or two that view themselves as wolf advocates and wolf lovers, and that's fair. And I think it's fair to say that it'd be great if we could have wolves in our wild places and wild ecosystems, even thriving. And I think that visual would be, you know, wolves living in wilderness areas that you don't have a lot of human traffic, you don't have livestock, and they're living amongst abundant herds of elk and deer and antelope and porcupines and skunks and possums and all these other critters that they might feed on. And that to me is a charismatic and attractive vision. I think that sounds great. A problem that we have right now is to get to that point in California is that we don't have abundant, thriving herds of elk and deer and antelope for those wolves to thrive on. And then, you know, the wolf advocates might say, well, the wolves will only succeed if those herds are there. So it's just about the ecosystem that can support them. That might be true, but the problem is that what we're seeing is that wolves in California and a lot of other places where they recolonize close to humans is they're heavily subsidized by livestock and other sources of food from humans, goats, you know, I guess those would be livestock, small ruminants, goats, sheep, cattle, horses, etc. So we're not developing, and because of that, I don't think we're developing a good base of wolves that are even wild. You know, the wolves that have been spending a lot of time in northern California right now, they have no care if humans are within stone's throw of them. Like, they'll stand there and stare at you from 50 yards and just look at you like, I don't care that you're there.
Are these wolves that are all collared?
No, not all collared.
Okay.
Some of the wolves that are up in Modoc aren't collared. Most of them aren't collared, actually. And I know one of the ranchers was telling me, like, the wolves were just across the fence, like 50, 100 feet away.
Right.
And the wolf had no concern about this human who should be the only animal that the wolf is concerned about. The human should be the only animal, other than maybe a grizzly bear, that wolves care about and are concerned about. But they're not concerned about humans. They're getting a high percentage of their food source from humans, so they're subsidized. And so that when we do have a bad winter and the other prey species, you know, they have a big die-off because there's a terrible winter or a terrible drought, well, the wolves are subsidized by human food, livestock, so they don't feel that pinch from nature. So we're effectively developing this we're, you know, because they're protected so completely, there's no friction against them interacting in human-settled areas, taking human-provided food. They're not fearful of humans. They're not really developing as a wild species living their best life on the wild landscape right now. And I don't know at what point you can reverse that, because these wolves, they learn from the family, the pack that they're in. They learn from their parents. They learn from their other pack mates. And if every generation of these wolves is getting, you know, 20 to 30% of their protein, their food from livestock, at what point do we say, oh, we need to reverse that trend?
Well, and they also have interaction with humans at the same time.
And there's no friction. Those interactions are not negative.
Right.
To a wolf. And so how do you reverse that? Like, you know, if we go from 100 wolves now, or say there's 100 to 200 wolves now, 3-4 years from now there's 400 to 600 wolves, when do we just magically make the decision, oh, we're going to start introducing friction now and the wolves will learn? Like, that's a reality check that doesn't just happen overnight.
No.
Like, we don't have a magic wand to wave to fix that.
Well,
so when, I think we're developing like kids that don't get like the kids that don't give you know, aren't given guardrails in third grade. They, you know, they don't necessarily behave well in 12th grade.
Yeah, yeah, which is 100% true, 100% of the time.
Right.
The other piece of this that I mean, we should ultimately highlight for people are the diseases that wolves bring in. And so the closer they come into human population, could be maybe you just hike in the woods. Maybe you're not a hunter. You don't live in a rural area, but you take your family out. And if wolves have kind of overtaken that landscape, A, you're in danger. But B, you cross up with some of the diseases that they carry and take that home.
Yep.
That's potentially
well,
deadly.
Those diseases also cross over to other species.
Right.
You know, your deer right. and everything else will end up with the same issue.
Yeah.
You mentioned the human safety part in hiking. I spend a lot of time in the woods. I've only seen a mountain lion in person once. I know mountain lions have seen me probably more times than I want to know. But I've only seen a mountain lion one time, and it was a little bit hair-raising. I've seen a lot of bears. I sleep on the ground in the woods with no tent. Like I just, if a bear's to me, it's going to make a little bit of noise, snortling in my face, and then run away probably, because that's what black bears mostly do. But I was hiking when I came up to Modoc County for the meeting to go on a hike on like a 1,000-acre ranch by myself, and I was hiking. Thought, oh shucks. Oh, and I rarely carry a weapon.
Mic check.
Because I'm not worried about it. You know, I'm about the critters attacking me because most of them are scared of me. And the next morning as I'm doing this hike, I'm realizing, you know what, if I came across three wolves in this area right now, they wouldn't be afraid of me. And it gave me a little bit of like we're getting point in a lot of California from the Tahoe North. You could find a wolf any given day, any area, Tahoe to the Oregon border, that if you come with a wolf or three wolves in that area, they're not scared of you.
Right.
And they will attack your dog. They will attack your dog. You know, so it's like we're in a new space now because animals don't have any friction. They have no reason to be concerned about human engagement. And that's a problem.
Well, there's, you know, the one word. If I was in a coma and you wanted to wake me up, all you have to do is come in my hospital room and say Fladry. Mm-hmm. I would just jump out of that bed, probably pummel you. It just makes me absolutely go mental. It's the myth of their stupid Fladry, which, for people who don't have to attend annoying meetings about this kind of stuff, is stupid little pieces of rags, little colored pieces of rags that are going to tie them on the fences, and the Fladry will blow in the wind, and the wolves will run away in fear. I'm like, okay.
Right.
Okay. Much more likely they would dress up in clothing and hide in a house, in a bed, and wait for Little Red Riding Hood. Much more likely.
Yeah, I've never heard the Fladry part.
Oh, you never heard about Fladry?
No, I never have.
Said it the other night. I was like, God dang it. So what about all the places that don't have fences? What is the real thing on that these days? Like, they made it sound like, we will come out there and we will put up Fladry for you. What's that meaning these days?
How did this work?
Your signal is going cuckoo all of a sudden.
Fine.
Yeah.
Okay. Hang on.
Here we have the. Better. It's funny. The traffic board is busting in and telling us things like mic check. We don't know what that's about. She's out there trying to figure that out, and all of a sudden your signal's going away. I'm like. Conspiracy.
How am I now?
It's the Center for Biological Diversity. They've hacked the station. What?
Probably. Am I better now?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, years ago,
I lied. You're not better.
No, you're breaking up real bad.
Now it's going crazy.
Okay. Better now.
I don't know. Keep talking.
My goodness.
Are you on a? Are you on a? On a microphone?
A speaker. He's the communications coordinator for Hal. Come on. Guy's a professional.
Know.
He knows
know.
This stuff.
Well, no, I do 13 communications. I don't coordinate them. You good now? No?
It's weird. Something happened to your signal. You were really good at the beginning, but something's kind of gone a little bananas. Hey, so we're figuring that out. I don't know what's going on in Engineering Town. Oh, she said she sent me a message in Engineering Town.
I can hear you really well.
Okay. Well, I come from I come from a family with very loud voices, so you know everybody can always hear the Ryans. there has never been anyone who said, "Gosh, those Ryan kids! I didn't even know where they were."
How are we doing? How are you now?
Oh, that's much
better. That's really good.
Yeah. I'm standing out looking at a hailstorm that just came through. So that's good.
Oh, that might be it.
Yeah, I think the clouds came in and dampened the signal or something. So, but, you know, 500 years ago, how did this work? You know, I don't think that the human settled areas and the folks that lived on North America 500 years ago let wolves just walk through their settlement and take whatever they wanted to. So why were wolves scared of humans 500 years ago? It's because the humans would kill them if they got too close and they were competing for space and resources. And so that friction creates a very natural balance to, you know, the habitat. And we're being told, go install bright lights and disco balls and waving flags and all this. So I'm just imagining, like, somebody hiking out in the woods or enjoying the wilderness. They come up over the ridge and they look down at night, you know, at dusk, and it looks like there's a electronic dance concert going on in the valley, with all these noises and flags and lights to keep the wolves away.
Oh, terrific.
And is that really what we, yes, we have all this modern stuff, but is that really what's stewarding the land looks like?
Yeah. Is that giving the wolves really their best environment to live in? I don't think so.
Right. And it works once. I think it does work. I think there's a point where it works. Wolves see that like, oh, this wasn't here last time I came through. You know, they do their, you know, they got hundreds of square miles that they cover at their habitat, and they might have like a month, like a 30-day loop that they make as they cover their habitat. And so, they come up and they see this, and they're startled by it, and they kind of stay away, just like a new puppy stays away from something that it hasn't seen before. But then, you know, they come back to it again a month later, and it's still there, like, that's interesting. And then they're hungry and they see a critter of a lamb or a goat or a calf on the other side of it. And they're like, I'm going to take a shot at that. I'm not so worried about that flag light thing anymore.
Yeah,
I've seen it a few times. And then they get that positive reinforcement of getting food and now they don't care about that anymore. So I think there's been studies that show it works, but I don't think there's been studies that show it works for 5 years.
See, that's the kicker. It just is, I don't know.
It feels good for the moment, but it doesn't actually create a sustainable impact.
Yeah, they used to come up with that all the time, and even back then everybody was like, wait a second, little wavy rags on a fence. Besides that, if you're out in open range land, mm-hmm. it's not all fenced. That's why we call it open range, you know?
Right.
I mean, they're kind of assuming everybody's got 5 acres with a little animal in the background, and that's not real. So, we have to break for the news. And then we're going to come back with our guest, Mike Costello, who is with Howl for Wildlife. And you can find all the info about them and the archive of the show later today at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Whoa!